When I read the news, I suddenly remember the remark he had made when I had asked him if he didn't get tired on those long drives. "No," he replied. "Sometimes I go to sleep and let the spirits take over." Part 3. 1. Spiritism, said Alan Kardec, would be scientific or it would not survive. I am afraid he was wrong, at least with regard to Brazil, for although the doctrine he codified and popularized has definitely survived, relatively few of its followers can be described as scientific in their approach by the wildest stretch of the imagination. This helps account for the fact that psychical research was late in arriving in Brazil, and is still in its infancy. There are further reasons. Brazilian spiritists tend to assume that all necessary scientific proof of their faith has already been obtained. Did not Sir William Crookes, Charles Richer, Frederick Myers, Gabriel Delanne, Ernst Bottiano and others satisfy themselves of the reality of almost all common phenomena associated with it? Were they not scientific enough, especially the first two? As to the question of investigating phenomena in present times, they point out that spiritism is a religion and a philosophy as well as a science. It has now grown out of its scientific stage, somehow surviving intact despite its critics' efforts, and should be accepted as a religion on its own merits. Who, they ask, sets out to investigate Roman Catholicism nowadays? How about trying to prove scientifically some of the Pope's wilder dogmas? Most of Brazil's more interesting psi phenomena have taken place in the past within the spiritist movement, or closely connected with it. To those within, they have been proved enough already, while to those without, the whole movement is a lot of nonsense and not worth investigating anyway. On the whole, Brazilian spiritists are none too concerned whether other people accept their beliefs or not. They are too busy practicing their faith and setting what they hope will be an example to others of militant, but never aggressive, Christianity to worry about their critics. They are also trusting souls, erring sometimes on the side of suggestibility and credulousness, but quick to take offense if doubts are cast on their personal integrity, let alone their sanity. Mediums, in particular, soon tend to gather groups of admirers or helpers round them, and these often feel it their duty to keep their idol protected from the curious at all costs. In my experience, such admirers are far more of a problem than the mediums themselves. To them, anyone described as an investigator is assumed at first to be either a secret policeman or a journalist bent upon destroying spiritism, and is treated accordingly. The situation is far from hopeless, however. Brazilian spiritists are the kindest and most charitable people imaginable, and if researchers approach them with the claim that they are trying to understand their religion rather than expose its side effects as fraud, they will be given a warm welcome and all the help they need, or most of it. There is a growing tendency today for Brazilians to feel that spiritism is well enough entrenched to allow for more serious research into it than has been permitted in the past. It is not so long ago since spiritists in Brazil had to stay underground or literally fight for survival if they came into the open. When Kardecism was a salon affair in its early days, and was largely restricted to the private homes of the upper classes in Rio de Janeiro, a city where just about any kind of behavior is tolerated, it attracted no serious opposition. But when it spread into the interior, it often came up against open hostility from the Catholic Church, which until the end of the 19th century had enjoyed a total monopoly over Brazilian souls, and like all monopolists was unwilling to give up without a fight. Dr. Rafael A. Raineri told me that there was a time when it was quite common for spiritist centers in the interior to be stoned by mobs. Once, he added, a procession had been organized by a local priest to the center where he was working. "They were out to kill me," he recalled. Times have changed. When I interviewed him, Raineri was one of Sao Paulo's highest-ranking police commissioners. When I turned up to interview him in his office, he was sitting on his desk coiling his gun, which, he told me proudly, he had never had to use on duty. "You must remember," he told me, "that Brazilians are religious people. For more than 300 years this was a Catholic country, and today most of our spiritists come from recent Catholic backgrounds. They retain their respect for religion, and when science looks like clashing with religion they will opt for the latter. Don't forget that the Brazilian spiritist is a missionary, helping prepare his country for a very serious mission, the founding of a civilization of human fraternity and a world of real peace. Rainieri added that in his long experience mediums had rarely objected to being researched by outsiders, though often their surrounding groups had been less willing. He also made the point that the better class of spiritist group, where the more dramatic effects were obtained, was usually restricted to a small number of advanced spiritists who knew each other well, and were reluctant to admit outsiders to their sessions even if they were spiritists, let alone non-spiritist investigators. An American team once turned up in Sao Paulo to investigate a very reputable medium, armed with the whole works from Faraday cage to handcuffs and all sorts of electrical gadgets. The poor medium was scared out of her wits, though anxious to help, and produced nothing at all under the conditions she was subjected to. The Americans concluded that she was a fraud. I later concluded just the opposite. The medium in question was the psychic surgeon I have called Maria and described in a previous chapter. Researchers in Brazil must make haste very slowly and tactfully. They are in the position of outsiders trying to join a club, that inner core of the spiritist movement where the really interesting things happen. To join any club one must provide valid reasons for wanting to do so, and if members misbehave they get thrown out. This has happened quite often to foreigners who step off the plane at Rio or Sao Paulo airports and demand to see the psychic action right away. Those who take their time, like Dr. Puharich, end up with what they want, as to some extent I also did. The individual most responsible for the improvement in serious researchers' prospects in Brazil was Chico Xavier. He always welcomed publicity of any kind, though he never sought it, and he showed spiritists that they had nothing to fear if they were genuine, as he most unquestionably was. Much of Chico's life was lived in public, and he is never known to have refused an interview. The more publicity he was given the more converts he won over. Dr. Rainieri also played an important part in making spiritism both respectable and researchable. He was one of the first Brazilian spiritists to write about his own experiences in a straightforward and honest, if hardly scientific, manner. Pride of first place in serious scientific research into paranormal phenomena in Brazil must go, however, to a foreigner, Andrea Puharich. It was he who had the patience to seek out Arigatilda Cubed and persuade him, over a lengthy period, to submit himself to organized investigation. The Ubrabo affair, which I have already described, was a serious setback for researchers, since it left many spiritists with the feeling that so-called scientific research was only a means by which the Catholic press sought to discredit their religion. Yet, while this sordid controversy was at its height, a Sao Paulo civil servant and engineer quietly announced the foundation, in December 1963, of the Instituto Brasileiro de Pesquisas Psicobiofísicas, IBPP, or Brazilian Institute for Psychobiophysical Research. The somewhat unwieldy name was chosen in order to make it clear that the institute intended to explore biological and physical as well as purely psychical phenomena. The most significant thing about it was that it emerged from within the spiritist movement itself. Hernani Guimarães Andrade, its founder and the pioneer of serious psychical research in Brazil by Brazilians, was born in 1913 in the town of Aragari in the state of Minas Gerais. This is the state that has also produced many of Brazil's most outstanding mediums, including Chico Xavier and Arigatilda Cubed, and is generally regarded as the country's most psychic state. The rich mineral deposits that give the state its name, General Mines, are thought to have something to do with it. The mineiros, miners, as its natives are called, are known for their extreme caution. Jokes about them being similar to those made by Englishmen about the Scots. Andrade graduated from Brazil's leading university, that of São Paulo, in civil engineering in 1941. After a brief period working for state authorities there, and a year with the Standard Electric Company in Rio de Janeiro, he went to Volta Redonda to join the team that was helping set up Brazil's National Steel Company plant, the first of its kind in the country. He stayed more than 7 years, rising to the position of chief in 4 different departments, and he also taught physics for 3 years at the special technical college set up at the works to train future employees of what was soon to become Brazil's most important industrial plant. In 1952, he came to São Paulo to work for the state's water and electricity department, later serving on a number of state and federal government commissions. In 1968, he became technical director of the department's electricity and telephone division. In short, he had a good scientific background. He also had a good spiritist one, becoming an active one at the age of 17. He told me how this came about. One evening in 1930, he was at a friend's house when the discussion turned to the subject of life after death. Hernani announced, when his opinion was asked for, that he regarded life as an essence independent of the physical body that animated it, and that after bodily death this essence went away to reappear in another living being awaiting birth. On hearing this, his friend's father had leapt from his chair and rushed out of the room, returning with a book in his hand. "Go home and read this," he ordered. "You've got advanced ideas for your age." The book was Alan Kardec's What is Spiritism? And young Hernani was somewhat hesitant about reading it, for he came from a strictly Catholic family and was a student in a high school run by Catholic priests. He read it at a sitting, however, and immediately read everything else by Kardec. "I found I had been a spiritist all along without knowing it," he told me. Before long, he was regularly attending spiritist sessions, welcoming his newly revealed faith yet retaining a critical eye. At one session held in his own home, a prominent local spiritist put on an impressive display of physical effects in a darkened room, making a record player perform, lights move and voices speak, provoking cries of ecstasy from the small audience. After the session was over, Hernani went back into the room and did a few experiments, calling to his friends a few moments later, "Hey! I've discovered I'm a physical effects medium, too. Come back in here and see." They all duly trooped back into the room. Hernani turned the light out and proceeded to reproduce everything the group had just witnessed. After suitable verbal preparation in his best graveyard voice, he hoisted the record player onto his shoulder, making the first bars of the record play with the edge of his fingernail while holding a small torch in his mouth and ringing a bell with his other hand. At the same time, he managed to boom out some platitudes in a cavernous voice, until soon the room was resounding with cries of thanks to God for this magnificent display of his power. He kept up the performance until the end, and never revealed to his friends that he had tricked them. Instead, he began to educate himself to become a proper researcher in the field of what used to be known as metaphysics. He taught himself enough French and English to be able to read the standard works on the subject, and before long became convinced that here in Brazil he had something that no would-be researcher before him had ever had, a ready abundance of genuine original material to study. Not all the sessions he attended were fakes, and though he never witnessed any really startling phenomena himself in his youth, he was convinced at an early age that Spiritism was a valid doctrine, and that some of its basic tenets, such as reincarnation and the possibility of communication with spirits, should be verifiable by scientific methods. His first book, The Corpuscular Spirit Theory, appeared in 1958 and quickly sold out 2 editions. It was followed in 1960 by New Ways Towards Spiritist Experimentation. The 2 books were the result of 30 years of self-education, observation, and a great deal of thought. In them, he put forward the hypothesis that the spirit world could be described by a scientific terminology parallel to that used to describe physical matter. It was a real thing, with its own atomic and molecular structure and its own mechanism of interacting with the physical world. The first book contained what was probably the first detailed hypothesis of the reincarnation process to be published anywhere, examined from the biological, physical and chemical points of view as well as the spiritual. The chapter on heredity was for some time the only material available in Portuguese that included an account of the work on the DNA molecular structure that won a Nobel Prize for Messrs. Crick, Wilkins and Watson in 1962. For a time, it was used as a textbook in a biology class at the University of São Paulo, where students and professors alike could find no fault in the presentation of the scientific data, however surprised they may have been by the title of the book, with its suggestion that the spirit world was as real as the physical one. Although Andrade's corpuscular spirit theory is highly complex, the initial stated aims of the IBPP were extremely simple. Our fundamental objective is the study of paranormal facts and systematic research into the laws, properties and potential of the spirit by scientific methods. Its five founder members were all spiritists, but they made it clear that their work was not to be tied to any religious considerations. It was to be an impartial examination of the facts. In his second book, Andrade described some of the methods by which the scientific department of the IBPP, his special responsibility, was to go after the facts. The first piece of equipment to be built was called the electromagnetic space condenser, designed to examine the effects of a biomagnetic field on the reproduction of bacteria. The second was what has become known as a Curlian camera, a device invented by Soviet electrician Semyon Curlian and his wife Valentina to photograph effluvia from animate and inanimate objects through the use of a thing called a Tesla coil, which makes effects visible that cannot be seen by the naked eye. The IBPP built three Curlian devices, probably the first outside the former USSR, the largest of which could photograph objects the size of a human hand. While work was going ahead on these and number of other devices in the Andrade family garage, IBPP members were out in the field gathering all the information they could on anything that seemed relevant to psychical research. It was the first time this had been done in an organized manner in Brazil. Hernani and his small unfinanced team were doing what Frederick Myers and his more prosperous colleagues were doing when they founded the Society for Psychical Research in London. The two most profitable lines of inquiry at first were those of poltergeists and reincarnation. Each had been well studied elsewhere, and there was plenty of published information to give the researchers an idea of what to look for. Brazil seemed to have an unusual amount of poltergeist activity causing havoc all over the place, and also a number of people who could remember what they thought might be a previous existence. It was time, Andrade and his colleagues felt, that such incidents and experiences were thoroughly examined, fully documented and where possible published. While gathering evidence in these two fields, the IBPP also tried its hand at a full-scale investigation of a single incident, a supposed spirit communication involving a dead soldier named Reitenberg Rocha, who dropped in uninvited on a spiritist meeting in São Paulo in 1961, providing a mass of verifiable information, though an amateur medium, about his life and death almost 30 years previously that Andrade and his colleagues were able to confirm from Brazilian army archives. A full report on this remarkable case is now available in an English translation. 1. By its 10th birthday, in December 1973, the IBPP had three filing cabinets bulging with first-hand material, including tape recordings, photographs and personal accounts of unusual happenings. By that date its executive council consisted of 11 people, including three qualified engineers, three school teachers, a doctor and an engineering student, Ricardo Andrade, who was to follow his father and two elder brothers into the engineering profession. The IBPP managed to stay on good terms with other spiritists, mainly because of its cautious attitude towards publicity. Andrade was often approached for interviews by the Brazilian press, and usually declined politely. He was reluctant to discuss anything in public that could not be supported by evidence in the Institute's files, and the following chapters contain only a very small amount of what is to be found in those files. I begin with my own original reports, which I have left unaltered, on two interesting people I met in São Paulo, a versatile artist and, apparently, a former prostitute from Pompeii. 2. Luis and Celia, Saturday, June 8, 1974. It is 6 p.m., and I am sitting at a large table with six other people in a São Paulo Spiritist Center. The young man directly opposite me is Luis Antonio Gasparetto, aged 24, a social worker and psychology student who for the past 10 years or so has produced a steady stream of work in what appears to be a relatively rare field nowadays, that of psychic art. Luis has never sold a picture, or even tried to, and he has never learned to draw. Those are just two of the unusual things about him. Artists have often been known to go into a trance and produce work unlike what they can do in their normal state, if any artist worth the name can ever be said to be in a normal state. William Blake, for instance, seems to have been in a trance for much of his life. Trance painting by untrained mediums was a popular phenomenon in the 19th century, the work of Victorien Sardou and the Scotsman David Dugard attracting much attention. In this century we have had interesting trance art from Augustin Lesage, a French miner, and from professionals like Austin Spare and Ingo Swann, while in England a lady named Coral Polge does fine pencil drawings of spirits she claims to see around her sitters. My friends, who have heard of most of these people, assure me that Luis has some surprises in store for me, as indeed he has. We sit in silence for a few minutes. On the table between Luis and myself is a pile of 14 pieces of thick drawing paper, measuring 28 by 20 inches, and a new box of 60 artists' crayons of all colors. I have already taken elementary precautions against possible fraud, holding each sheet of paper up to the light, making sure it was blank and that there were no concealed finished drawings in the pile. I do not feel it necessary to search the medium, since you cannot very well hide a 28 by 20 inch drawing up your sleeve. The session begins. It is, they have told me, a regular Saturday evening session held whether there are visitors like myself present or not. The purpose of the sessions is to enable Luis to develop his abilities under the orientation of his spirit guides. These, I am assured, include a host of discarnate artists such as Manet, Renoir, Modigliani, the Brazilian Tarsila do Amaral and many others. The bright lights are switched off, leaving the room lit only by two weak red bulbs some 12 feet from where Luis and I are sitting. I notice that in the red light you cannot tell one color from another, though it is light enough to see what is going on and also to write on my notepad. At 6.13, Luis goes suddenly into action. Leaning his head on his left hand and turning slightly to the left, he runs the fingers of his right hand over the crayons in the box, without looking at what he is doing. With his face still covered, he attacks the paper with his right hand with such energy that the paper starts to slide around on top of the pile. I hold down the corners nearest me with two fingers. In just under 3 minutes, Luis has completed a vivid portrait of a girl, his hand flying over the paper at astonishing speed as soon as he has finished and signed. From where I am it looks like Renoir. The woman beside him lifts it off the pile and he starts another drawing without a moment's pause. Very interesting, I say to myself. It cannot be easy to draw in semi-darkness even without a hand in front of your face. But it is hardly paranormal. What else can he do, I wonder? As if reading my thoughts, Luis embarks upon his next drawing. Taking a new chalk, he makes the outline of a face at great speed, still without looking at what he is doing, and immediately sketches in a pair of eyes at the bottom of the face. For a moment I decide he has missed out on this one, but as his hand continues to fly around the paper, jabbing at it like a high-speed boxer in a hurry to finish off his opponent, it gradually dawns on me that he is doing a portrait upside down, or the right way up as seen from my position. I begin to feel quite impressed. He draws upside down as quickly and assuredly as he does the right way up, and the new portrait is finished in a little over 3 minutes. Next, he takes the pile of paper and turns it sideways, picking up a chalk in each hand, and proceeds to draw two heads at once, one beside the other. Luis's two heads are quite different, and his two hands seem totally independent of each other, though I notice that occasionally one hand will jump across the paper to help the other with its portrait. while one hand dots in an eye, right on the spot, the other shades in a background of the other head. I would have said this performance was almost impossible, but one never really finds out what human beings can be capable of. Luis seems to pick up that thought as well, because for his next picture he repeats the phenomenon of drawing two heads at once. This time, however, he introduces yet another refinement. One of the heads is the right way up and the other is upside down. I feel distinctly impressed. As he starts his next picture, I fear Luis has gone mad. He picks up a light-colored crayon. It is difficult to tell what color in the dim red light, though one can tell light from dark shades, and using the side of it he makes a huge oval blob in the middle of the paper, like a furious child just making a mess. When he is satisfied with his blob, which has used up almost the whole of the crayon, he picks up a darker one, makes a few lightning strokes on the paper, and in a matter of seconds there is an unmistakably Modigliani-like face in front of me. To imitate a Modigliani portrait cannot be too difficult, with those oval faces and exaggeratedly long necks. Luis promptly does it again, only this time he starts with the outline of the face and fills in the blank spaces later, using several different crayons. At this stage it occurs to me that every drawing so far has been made in a different way. We have had linear portraits drawn with great precision, another in a more impressionistic style with economy of line, and another with the strong color areas and bold strokes of an expressionist. It seems I am being given a demonstration of every possible way of reproducing the human face on paper. The only feature I can detect that is common to nearly all of them is a kind of aura effect around the faces. It is not an exaggerated aura, such as you find in paintings of saints, but just a faint outline following the contour of the cheek. On more than one occasion I notice that Luis draws the outline of a face in thick strokes, then throws the chalk aside and immediately picks up another lighter one and follows the outline of the face exactly with the second chalk. The chalks, incidentally, may have begun the evening in a nitro in their box, but before long Luis has used more than half of the 60, and their stumps are lying all over the place. And more than once I note that he locates a color he has already used and discarded in order to complete a certain line or shaded area. The session ends at 7.05, by which time Luis has produced a total of 14 drawings, averaging just under 4 minutes each. Throughout the session neither he nor I have spoken a word until the start of the last picture, another of his double portrait feats. At this point, Luis starts to speak in a voice they told me later was that of the center's spirit guide-in-chief, a certain Father Zabe, who is well known in local spiritist circles. Luis certainly gives a fair impression of speaking in the voice of an elderly priest, and for 3 or 4 minutes there he is, drawing two portraits at once and delivering a homely little sermon at the same time. This may be possible, but normal it is not. After the session, the lights are turned on again and Luis looks at his evening's output, like a photographer eager to see how his film has come out. He gives no sign of having any recollection of what he has been up to for the past hour. I am struck by the quality of the drawings. They might not pass for original Renoirs or Modiglianis, but they would decorate any home wall. They are all full-face portraits, none of them of anybody present, and each face has a lively expression and an air of serenity about it. Although done at frantic speed, they bear no resemblance to the lightning cartoons people often do in cafes and bars for tourists. They are pleasing pictures skillfully drawn in the styles of the artists whose names were signed on them. I decide without much hesitation that Luis should be investigated more thoroughly, and promptly make arrangements to return the following Saturday with the full IBPP research team, to which Luis agrees at once. The following week, Niprito Perez of the IBPP shot about 20 minutes of color film of Luis at work, while Suzuko Hashizume tape recorded the sound of his hand flying over the paper, and Hernani Gimeriz Andrade and I took nearly 200 color slides of the session. When we showed the film later, nobody could believe it. It looked as though it had been speeded up, like an old Keystone Cops comedy. We checked the projector and found it in perfect order. We showed other films, which appeared to be running at the right speed. I went over my original notes and found the time of each drawing matched with the film. This was quite an interesting situation.